Good Sunday morning. Thank you for joining us here on the iHeart Community Spotlight, a weekly 30-minute public affairs program. I'm Mark Carbonaro, host of the program, and our guest this week is Dana Allen Greel, who is the Director of Digital Strategy at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. Now, we're not going to be talking about the aquarium, although that is a fascinating topic to talk about. I can tell you that much, and maybe we'll touch on that for a moment. But really, we're talking with Dana because she has type 1 diabetes, and the JDRF, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, is having their annual One Walk event coming up next weekend on Sunday, October 6th at Lovers Point Park in Pacific Grove. And this is an event where annually walkers, volunteers, and sponsors raise money to make living with type 1 diabetes safer and healthier until it's no longer a threat. So Dana has been living with this much of her life, and so she's joining us today to talk about type 1 diabetes. Dana, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you with us. And let's talk a little bit about what is type 1 diabetes and when were you diagnosed?
Sure. So I was diagnosed about 13 years ago. I was actually 27 years old. And so I learned a lot about type 1 diabetes 13 years ago.
Wow.
At a very basic level, when you have type 1 diabetes, which we sometimes in the community call T1D. So when you have T1D, your pancreas basically stops producing insulin.
Mm-hmm.
And insulin is the hormone that helps your body get energy from food.
Okay.
So without insulin, the glucose from food just stays in your blood instead of being absorbed by your body. So that's why you might hear someone with diabetes talking about having a high blood sugar, and that's because they need to get insulin to help them process that sugar and get it into their organs and working the way that it should if your pancreas was doing what it was supposed to.
Dana, you mentioned the fact that you first found out that you had type 1 diabetes when you were 27 years old. Mm-hmm. When they examined you and looked at your medical history, did they say that your onset of diabetes was at the age of 27, or had you been living with it for a few years and not realized it?
Oh, no, you can't be living with type 1 diabetes for a few years and not realize it. It comes on very quickly. Essentially, it's an autoimmune disease. Scientists are not really sure what triggers it, but the cells in your pancreas are being attacked by your immune system until it stops producing insulin.
Okay.
And so you can't live without insulin. And so if you have type 1 diabetes, you need to be treated with insulin right away.
All
it's
right.
not something that you can live with.
You have what is also known as insulin-dependent diabetes.
Correct. Yeah.
All right.
So the way that I found out that, that that's what I had, I was very, very thirsty. I was drinking constantly and going to the bathroom constantly, and I lost a lot of weight very quickly. And when I finally went to get checked out, that's when they found that my blood sugar was very, very high.
Wow.
And your body's response to that is to try and get rid of it by flushing it out with water, which is why that's a symptom to look out for.
Mm-hmm. So were you dehydrated then?
Yes. And like I said, I'd lost a lot of weight. I was very tired and just did not feel good.
How long did these symptoms occur before you actually got medical attention and were diagnosed with diabetes?
Only a couple of days, really, maybe a week
wow.
or so.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes on pretty quickly.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me about this, and we have heard of some instances of people in adulthood contracting type 1 diabetes because traditionally it had been known as juvenile diabetes, and generally it was an onset when you're younger than the age of 18. I think the vast majority of people with type 1 diabetes had first experienced it or been diagnosed with it in their, you know, maybe 9, 10 years old or in their early teens, 11, 12, 13 years old, 15 years old, that kind of a thing. Was it unusual that you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 27?
It's not, actually. And as JDRF will say, today we know that an equal number of children and adults are diagnosed with type 1 diabetes every day, and they estimate about 110 people per day.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many people living who were diagnosed as children and as adults who are now adults living with type 1 diabetes.
Right.
So that's, I think, why we refer to it more by the name type 1 diabetes, or as you said, insulin-dependent diabetes, mm-hmm. rather than juvenile diabetes. It's just
right.
a bit of a misnomer now.
Yeah. Right, which traditionally it was known as juvenile diabetes, but now it's insulin
Correct.
Dependent. Now, the other type of diabetes, type 2, is primarily an adult onset diabetes, and that is treated with, I believe, pills, correct, and dietary changes.
Yeah, so they're actually pretty different diseases. So for one thing, when you have type 2 diabetes, your body still produces insulin, and when you have type 1, your pancreas does not produce insulin.
Mm-hmm.
The problem when you have type 2 diabetes is that your body is not using insulin efficiently anymore.
Okay, so you have an overproduction of it then? Or you're just not using what's produced.
You're not using what's produced effectively.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a metabolic disorder. It's not an autoimmune disease like type 1. It is more typically diagnosed in adulthood. Actually, my father has type 2 diabetes, and mm-hmm. he was diagnosed as an older adult. And some people with type 2 can treat it with pills, as you said. Some people with type 2 might also require insulin, either through injection or through an insulin pump. And my father actually has an insulin pump that's much like mine.
Really?
His disease came on very differently, was caused by different things, and can be treated differently. Although he does have an insulin pump, he also has other treatments, and sort of the way that his disease functions is different from mine. So that's, yeah, it's an interesting comparison in our own family. Yeah.
Was he diagnosed with it before yours or afterwards?
He was diagnosed before I was, yeah.
How much time was there between your diagnosis and his?
I don't actually recall, but there's really no connection at all.
Right.
So for if you have a parent with type 2, it has no bearing on whether you will have type 1.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, that we, as I said, we're just not really sure what causes type 1. And there doesn't seem to be a very strong genetic component, but there may be something there, but nothing definitive.
Mm-hmm. How many people have type 1 diabetes?
So about 1.25 million people, and as I said, about 110 people diagnosed a day.
What's it like to have type 1 diabetes, and how do you manage it?
It's pretty exhausting, to be honest. Some days feel easier than others, but it's a very relentless disease.
Mm-hmm.
I just recently read a study that people with type 1 diabetes make 180 more decisions per day than people without type 1 diabetes. So that's just a lot of mental work going on,
right,
in addition to what's happening with your body. So, for example, you wake up, you check your blood sugar to see where you are and see if you need more insulin to bring your blood sugar down, for example.
How do you check your blood sugar?
Oh, sure. So many people use a blood glucose meter, which requires you to get it's called a finger stick. You basically prick your finger with a small needle, get a little bit of blood, and it's able to read from a drop of blood what your blood sugar is. I happen to have a continuous glucose monitor, which is a device that reads my blood sugar every 5 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and is constantly tracking my levels over time.
Okay.
So that's the first thing you might do in the morning when you wake up, and then you need to decide what to eat for breakfast. You need to count how many carbs are in that, take the right amount of insulin for how many carbs you're about to eat. Think about what else you're doing that day. Are you about to get on your bike and ride to work like I do? In which case, you need to account for exercise, because exercise can help bring down your blood sugar.
Oh, okay. So I guess that's
insulin.
Yeah, that would be a good thing then, correct?
It is a good thing, except if you've taken the right amount of insulin for your food and then you drop your blood sugar more by exercising, you need to account for that before you take your insulin so you don't take too much.
Too little.
There are many days that I do the same exact thing, and what happens is a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's super frustrating. I could eat the same breakfast, have the same bike ride to work, and one day my blood sugar will go high, and another day my blood sugar will go low, and that can be caused by stress. It can be caused by the temperature outside. It can be caused by the time of the month if you're a lady. So
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of different factors, which can make it a really frustrating disease to live with, because it's not the same every day, even if you do the same thing every day.
Now, the last week notwithstanding, most of the time we have a pretty mild climate around here. You know, we don't have these great variations in temperatures as you would have, say, in a place like Florida or in the Midwest.
Sure.
Does the fact that we have a pretty mild or temperate climate here help with managing your diabetes?
A little bit. I actually just moved here about a year ago, and I came from the East Coast where there was a lot more fluctuation in temperature. The hardest days were actually like beach days, right? Like a hot beach day.
Mm-hmm.
Because you actually absorb insulin faster when it's warm.
Oh.
And so you'd have to kind of redo all of your calculations. You also have to keep insulin cold. It can't get really hot or it loses its effectiveness, which is why people keep it in the refrigerator.
Okay,
but
sure.
But when you are wearing an insulin pump like I do, your source of insulin is actually kind of worn on your body. And so whatever you're doing outside, it's going to affect the insulin. So I might have to keep my insulin in a cooler on the beach, for example, or take my pump off when I go swimming to keep it kind of regulated over time. So yes, I would say it helps a little bit, but it's really those extreme temperatures that cause mm-hmm. changes.
So in the last week when we had some very high temperatures in the 90s on the Monterey Peninsula, that must have been something for you to deal with then.
Yep, it's just one of many factors to think about. Like I said, it's mm-hmm. what you eat, what you're doing, if you're stressed or not, how much sleep you got, temperature. Yeah, there's a lot of factors to consider when you're when you're treating yourself with type 1.
Mm-hmm. And Dana, you check your blood glucose all the time, but you have the meter that does it, so you're not required to pin stick your finger all the time?
So my continuous glucose monitor tests my blood sugar constantly. That's why it's called continuous, but I do have to calibrate it. So that means for me, it means twice a day I need to do the finger stick with another meter, and then I basically sync them. You might also need to use your meter if something just seems off with your CGM, like it seems higher than you feel or lower than you feel, and you just want to double check that it's right, then you might use your additional meter to just make sure that your CGM is performing properly.
Yeah, I was curious about that. And as far as taking the pump provides you with a portioned amount of insulin throughout the day, so you're not in a position that maybe some people were years ago where they'd be taking a number of shots throughout the day.
Yeah, so when I was first diagnosed, I used the finger stick probably 10 or 15 times a day mm-hmm. for my meter, and then I gave myself shots every single time, shots of insulin every time I ate, as well as two shots a day with what's called long-acting insulin, so that's mm-hmm. insulin that'll kind of last in your system throughout the day. And it wasn't until I started talking with my doctor about wanting to get pregnant that they recommended I go on a pump because it can just give us kind of more information and deliver insulin more evenly throughout the day. It has some benefits in that way. Not everybody chooses that option, but I was really glad I did because that's when I was able to start using a continuous glucose monitor. Instead of having kind of 12 data points a day, I had data points every 5 minutes, and it would alarm if I was going high or going low. And I personally really love the pump because it makes a lot of the calculations easier. Instead of me having to do the math when I eat a piece of bread, that's 15 carbs. I just type in 15 carbs and it knows what my dose should be for that amount of carbohydrate. And it gives me that amount of insulin. Whereas when I was on daily injections, I had to do all that math in my head.
Wow. You know, you're talking about all these extra decisions that you have to make every day.
Right.
I guess that's all part of it. And it really is, you know, just a lot to be aware of that you're living with on a daily basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the thing that's interesting is type 1 is really not a very visible disease unless you happen to notice someone, you know, doing a finger stick or you notice their pump or something like that. But for anyone who ends up meeting someone with type 1 or becoming aware, to know that even if they look totally fine, all of this kind of background stress is going on to try and keep their blood sugar even, to essentially act as a pancreas, mm-hmm. use your brain as a pancreas. Whereas if you don't have type 1, you're kind of walking around all day with that just happening without you even knowing that it's happening.
Do you stress out about this, about maintaining everything? I mean, does it affect you?
Absolutely. I think whenever you have, kind of like I mentioned, unexpected lows or unexpected highs, you can get really hard on yourself. Like, what did I do differently mm-hmm. today? Or try and figure that out. It also physically doesn't feel good to be high or to be low. When you're high, you feel very sluggish and thirsty. When you're low, you can't even kind of form complete sentences. You feel shaky. You feel nervous. And that can lead to lots of not great things if you don't treat it quickly. So yes, I would say that it comes in waves, how stressful it is. Definitely when I was pregnant, I have two healthy babies, which is amazing. And honestly, something that even 100 years ago would not have been possible.
Right.
I had great endocrinologists, and with the help of my pump and my CGM, I was able to really get my blood sugar under very tight control,
mm-hmm.
Which you need to do when you're pregnant because blood sugar can really affect the baby. So mm-hmm. that was definitely a stressful time. But ended up with wonderful results, and I'm really glad about that.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
You know, I guess one thing I'm struck by, you talk about sometimes you'd be high or sometimes you'd be low, and it seems that in spite of the best efforts that you make to maintain a particular regimen, to really watch these things and to try and keep your blood sugar on as even a keel as possible, it sometimes does get out of limits for you. And I imagine that can be sometimes frustrating, you know, because you say to yourself, doggone it, you know, I'm doing the exact same thing I did yesterday. And why is it doing this to me today?
Yes, absolutely. That is probably the most frustrating part. And sometimes it's user error, right? You thought this meal had this many carbs and you counted wrong. And other times it really is. It's the same thing you ate yesterday and nothing changed. And
mm-hmm.
and it's just how your body wants to act that day. Or it could sometimes also be that your equipment is failing you. Sometimes your pump tubing gets clogged, or your meter or your continuous glucose monitor is a little off. off. And so you're making treatment decisions based off of bad data. There's a lot that can kind of go wrong. It's kind of amazing that we're able to make it work as much as we do, given so many things that can go wrong. And you kind of have to just learn to roll with it,
right,
and do your best to manage it and not be too hard on yourself when things go awry, because it happens to everybody.
Talk a little bit about your professional life and how you manage all this together. You're the director of digital strategies at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. How does living with type 1 diabetes factor into your daily life as far as managing it while on the job, and what kind of an impact does it have in your professional world?
Yeah, it's funny that you asked that, because I actually decided this year, as I'm raising money for the JDRF1 walk, I decided to do a series of stories on Instagram about what it's like a day in the life of someone with type 1. And I happened to pick a work day. So you see me kind of testing my blood sugar and, oh, it doesn't match my CGM and having to calibrate there. And then it was one of the days I rode my bike to work, and just like I do every day. And then my blood sugar dropped. And in the middle of a meeting, I had to run out and go get an apple juice, which I have stored in my office because apple juice is one of the things that brings your blood sugar right up. Everyone who I work with is really familiar with my insulin pump because it buzzes and alarms a lot to tell me that my blood sugar is doing this or that, or I need to calibrate. So I'm very open at work about my type 1, which is really helpful for me, because that way people can be more empathetic to what's happening and also help me if I need any help. Everyone knows where my apple juice is, just in case I need it. Actually, the interesting thing for me about work is that, as I said, I moved here about a year ago from D.C. for this dream job at the aquarium, and I was sitting in a meeting one day and my pump went off to tell me that my blood sugar was doing X or Y, and she kind of pulled me aside after and told me that her middle school age son has type 1 and was diagnosed 3 years ago, and that's a very just intense thing for parents to go through, and she's very active with JDRF, and she's the one who actually got me involved. She asked me to come join her at an event to learn about the One Walk, and I've just been really blown away by the community here in Monterey. You know, I came from D.C., which is, you know, a medium-sized city, presumably a larger population of people with type 1, and located right next to the epicenter of health research, you know, NIH and all of the National Institutes of Health. But I had never really kind of purposefully come across other people with type 1. With all that many people living in D.C., I'd never actually met another person with type 1.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And here in Monterey, which with a smaller town atmosphere, I've connected with several other people with type 1, as well as parents and grandparents of people with type 1, and just feel much more part of a community. And that's thanks to my coworker and thanks to JDRF. And it's been really interesting also just to learn more about what JDRF does and how I sort of been the beneficiary of their work without even maybe knowing it. The system I described to you, where I have a pump and a CGM, the unit that I use is actually what's termed sort of a quote-unquote artificial pancreas, because it monitors my blood sugar constantly, and then it helps make decisions to administer insulin as needed. So that's called a closed-loop system. And JDRF had a big part in making the artificial pancreas a reality. So I'm kind of a direct beneficiary in terms of the technology that I use every day, but also a beneficiary of their work by being connected to this community of other people with type 1 or people who are fighting for better treatment, for cure, and for prevention.
Mm-hmm. So you're raising money now for JDRF. You're involved with them. They've spent more than $2 billion in research and funding since their inception. And what would you really like to do as a volunteer with JDRF? What's, you know, do you have like any sort of goal in mind? Or
yeah, I mean, I think I've learned over the years how important just being available and being a spokesperson and being an advocate can be by being open about my type 1 and answering people's questions. I think people feel really comfortable asking me questions, which is great, because I get to be an ambassador for this disease that is otherwise very invisible. You know, I think we all would really like a cure. We all would like better treatments until a cure is found, and we'd all like to prevent this disease from happening to anybody else. So whatever I can do to play a role in that, I want to be part of.
So you're about 40 years old right now.
Mm-hmm.
You've had diabetes.
Yes, I am.
Type 1 diabetes for 13 years. Have you had a chance to talk to other people with type 1 diabetes that are substantially older than you, maybe senior citizens who've lived with it all their lives, and maybe discuss with them what they've experienced so that you can learn what to expect as you age with this disease. Like what anything changed? Like, you know, you might say to someone, well, did anything change in your 40s, between 40 and 50, with how you managed the disease and now today? I mean, because obviously you're going to live with this for the rest of your life. You'd probably like to know, what's it going to be like when I'm 50 or 55 or 60 or 65 or 70?
Yeah, I think this is the thing that's really amazing. So the technologies for treating diabetes have changed so much and in such a short time. There are a couple people here locally who are much older, who are now on the same, you know, systems that I'm on, but have lived through many other types of treatments.
Mm-hmm.
I actually used to work in D.C. at the National Museum of American History, which is part of the Smithsonian, and they have a medical history collection. So I was actually working there when I was diagnosed, and I got to talk with the curators there and to actually see artifacts in the collection related to kind of the very first treatments for diabetes. So when insulin was first discovered about 100 years ago, and they would actually extract it from animals, and then they learned how to make it artificially. The equipment that people used to use, the needles were enormous and scary. You used to have to go to the doctor to get your blood sugar tested. You couldn't do that at home. Then the first meters came out. They were the size of a backpack.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and now I wear this tiny little computer on my body every day that makes decisions for me. And that's all within 100 years, so it's pretty amazing. So I absolutely love to talk to people who are older than me and understand what they've lived through, but I think, you know, we have a sense of what might be coming, but 50 years from now, it could be a completely different world for people with type 1, and we all hope it will be.
Yeah. I remember hearing a story. We do this program every year about JDRF, and I remember hearing a story from someone, an older person that I interviewed a couple of years ago, and they were talking about how many, many, in the very early days, as they were developing insulins, and, you know, just when the knowledge was so primitive about the disease, and they used to have a person with type 1 diabetes, you would urinate into a specimen cup, right? And you would put that in order to check the relative sugar level in your blood. You know, they'd have you pee in a specimen cup. They'd put it next to a window and see how many flies and ants came towards it because of the sugar content in there. Aren't you glad that we're beyond those days?
Absolutely, yeah. And it really is kind of amazing to me, you know, before the discovery of insulin, which I said was about 100 years ago. Actually, type 1 diabetes has been around forever, and there's documentation of it in ancient history, actually. The treatments about 100 years ago were basically a starvation diet until you died within a year.
Oh, my gosh.
That was the treatment, right? They could keep you alive a little bit longer by feeding you cabbage, because cabbage doesn't have a whole lot of carbohydrates, and so your blood sugar would stay lower. And that's just 100 years ago. So it's pretty amazing to think that now, A, I can live longer than a year. I don't have to eat cabbage every day. I was able to have two amazing healthy babies and go about my day in much the same way as people without type 1 in so many ways that, yes, I'm absolutely grateful to be alive today thanks to modern medicine.
I was just going to say that. Ago. Thank goodness for modern medical science.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it takes a lot of knocks, you know, lately, boy, where would we be without it? I mean, people in your situation, diabetes was a death sentence. 100 years ago, it was a death sentence.
Yep.
And so,
yep, absolutely.
And here you're able to live a normal life.
Yeah. You know, I don't want to downplay. It's still very challenging. The technology is amazing, but it can still be very frustrating. It doesn't do everything that we want it to do. It's very expensive, you know, which can be a real hardship for a lot of people, even with good insurance. Even just insulin is very expensive, let alone all of the supplies you need to run a continuous glucose monitor or insulin pump itself can be thousands of dollars. So it definitely, there's still a long way to go, but we've also come pretty far.
Sure. And imagine how things have changed in the 13 years since you were diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
How much farther it has come, and it's easier to manage the disease. Imagine what the future holds in another 15 or 20 years, where things could be. I mean, that's good. You know, the vision of even better management of the disease in another couple decades has to be exciting.
Absolutely, yeah. JDRF here in Monterey actually organizes what they call a tech talk, and they have kind of leading expert come and tell us what's kind of in the pipeline, either like, you know, immediately for FDA approval or what's being worked on by some of the major companies. They're looking at creating new kinds of insulins that work faster and pumps that are even smarter. So there's definitely a lot to be excited about in the future, but for sure we'd actually look for a cure.
Dana, before we go, we do want to talk about the One Walk coming up next week, and you're on the JDRF One Walk committee. Tell us about that event.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It takes place at Lover's Point, or it starts at Lover's Point in Pacific Grove, and the walk follows the Coastal Recreation Trail, which I think is one of the most gorgeous spots on Earth. It's a really beautiful walk route. My role on the committee is actually organizing the Kids Corner, and I'm really excited about that. As I mentioned, I have little kids. They're 5 and 3, thanks to my 2 healthy pregnancies. And so I'm really excited to kind of host an area for families and kids who are living with type 1 diabetes or who have a family member or friend with type 1 diabetes. And in the Kids Corner, we'll be doing crafts and face painting and games. For the walk overall, there'll be performances and music and lots of fun things to do. And so everyone is welcome to come down to Lover's Point Sunday, October 6th, 9 a.m. The walk starts, and you can come and join. You do need to register. You should register at walk.jdrf.org.
Mm-hmm.
And we look forward to seeing everybody there next week.
That'll be great. Hey, you mentioned something a moment ago that when your blood sugar drops, it's always good to have some apple juice handy because you drink that and it comes right back up. Is it just apple juice, or can you get the same impact with a candy bar or a glass of orange juice?
Everyone has their own favorite low treatment. Some people really love jelly beans.
Mm-hmm.
You can buy what are called glucose tabs at the pharmacy, which are basically like chalky little pills that you can chew on, kind of like Tums.
Mm-hmm.
Some people like gummy bears. Candy bar, it would depend. You don't want there to be a lot of fat in what you're eating, because that'll actually slow down the absorption of the carbohydrate. So you want something that's like as pure carbohydrate as possible. And for me, apple juice just goes down really easily when I'm already feeling shaky and low.
Okay. Well, that's great to know, because I was just thinking to myself, another month or so, I've got a friend who has type 1 diabetes who's going to come and visit for a few days, coming from out of town, going to stay for a few days. And I'm thinking, I should probably have some apple juice handy just in case.
Yeah, that's a great idea. You can also ask them what their favorite low treatment is. You can have it on hand.
Oh, capital idea. All right. Well, very good. We've been talking with Dana Allen Greel, and she is living with type 1 diabetes, was diagnosed at the age of 27, has had it for a number of years now. She's a member of the JDRF committee, that's Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation. They are holding the One Walk next weekend, a great fundraiser event that'll happen at Lovers Point Park in Pacific Grove. It's going to be on Sunday, the 6th of October. And once again, if you'd like more information on this, just go to walk.jdrf.org and register today. And Dana, I want to thank you so much for being our guest on the program.
Thanks again for having me.
And you've been listening to the iHeart Community Spotlight, a weekly public affairs program of iHeart Radio, Salinas, Monterey. And if you have questions about our programming, write to us in care of Public Affairs Director, iHeart Radio, 1550 Moffett Street, Salinas, California, 93905. And once again, thank you for listening to the iHeart Community Spotlight.